Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9. We're here on the That Conference stage. They have like a really cool like motif going here of like camping. We got like a little campfire.
It's all rustic.
Yeah,
you know?
It's fantastic.
We need some s'mores.
I wish, but this doesn't wish,
yeah.
This area right here. So tell us who you are and what you do, bud.
So my name is Matt Stratton. I'm the Senior Solutions Architect at Chef Software.
Okay.
And I'm also a very active participant in the DevOps community here. So I host a podcast called Arrested DevOps.
Oh, that's cool.
I am one of the organizers of DevOps Days Chicago.
Oh, so that's awesome. So you're really involved.
I'm very DevOps-y. And I have my license plate does say DevOps.
So let's start with let's start with this, because I come from the development side.
Sure.
People
I won't
make,
hold that against
yeah,
you.
Yeah, Joey and Rick, if you're watching, they make fun of me all the time. It's really tough. So help me understand as a developer, what is DevOps?
Sure. So DevOps means a lot of things to a lot of people, but this is kind of how we believe at Chef. Mm-hmm. So we believe that DevOps is a few things. That one, it's a technical and cultural movement that has automation at its core.
Okay.
We believe that it's a faster and safer way to deliver value to your customers. And then we also believe that it's a set of practices that were created by web innovators that are now being adopted by enterprises of all kinds.
So I love how you said that. Now pretend I'm a programmer.
Sure. Okay. What it basically does is, now I'm going to quote a guy named John Vincent, aka Lucis,
cool.
on Twitter, who wrote a great blog post a while ago called DevOps, a title match, and his definition of DevOps was giving a bleep about your job and never saying that's not my job.
Nice.
And in a lot of ways, that summarizes DevOps.
I understand that. Like, for example, like, I just write the code.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's going to end up somewhere.
Yeah.
You should care about where it ends up. And that
Absolutely.
Gap between writing the code and where it ends up, that's DevOps.
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely. Because the job of a programmer is not to write code, believe it or not. The job of a sysadmin is not to keep the website up. Our job is the same, which is to sell shoes, if that's what our company does.
That,
if our company doesn't sell shoes,
awesome.
Then it would be bad to sell shoes.
That's a really cool way of like maybe taking a time out and saying, what does my company do? I am responsible for that.
How do I help enable that? How do I help enable delivering that value? And
okay.
there's a lot of challenges in the traditional way that we've
sure.
been working to that. We're cross-incented, you know, if you think about it. And this is not a new idea that I'm coming up with.
Okay.
A lot of smarter people than I have said it. But to share it, if we think about it, developers tend to be incented according to how fast can you deliver a new feature, right? That's your thing. You're doing a good job
yeah.
if you're shipping features.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I'm a sysadmin, I'm incented against uptime. The site goes down, I'm doing my job poorly. Well,
it's and like you're at odds with
well,
each other.
We absolutely are. And my career has been in system administration. So I'm an ops person from way back. And so the thing that causes interruption in service is change, right? If you don't change a darn thing, then if nothing changes, then everything is happy. So we're trying to, you know, our micro incentives conflict.
They do.
But in reality, again, we're trying to do the same thing. We're trying to support the same business. And thinking about that, and so it's like you said, developer has to think about the fact that this code has to be operationalized.
Uh-huh.
It has to run somewhere. And then likewise, as an ops person, I have to realize that my job is not to get in the way of feature development and, you know, how can we promote stability? How can we be further embedded and understand, not just sit there and say, hey, IIS is running. I don't know what's wrong. Must be your code, right? That's very non-DevOps.
Feels like the first step of DevOps is like hug an IT guy from the developer side. You know what I'm saying?
You know, there's a lot of jokes about that. Like a lot of folks in the enterprise space when they want to kind of talk down on the DevOps community, because we talk a lot about empathy
mm-hmm.
in the DevOps community, because that's really what it's about. And
sure.
empathy is not necessarily about hug ops. I mean, it's important, you know, we should all get along, but just having people go out for beers or whatever, that doesn't do everything. The empathy is like, hey, if I'm a developer, let me spend a day like shadowing one of my sysadmin buddies and see what they do.
Sure.
And then if I'm a sysadmin, I should understand what developers do and their pressures and their thing. So it's empathy for understanding what we need to get our job done. And
right.
the reality is once you start doing that, you really do. You sit there and you start thinking about things in a different way.
It feels like, and I've programmed since I was like 16.
Yeah.
It's been like 20 years, and it's crazy to even think that that's how long we've been doing this
yeah.
stuff. But the longer I've been doing this, the more I realize that the problems that we have are human problems.
Absolutely. Technology's easy, man. People are hard.
Yeah,
you know, it's always
true.
A people problem.
It's true. So let's talk about Chef.
Sure,
because
absolutely.
It's something I've heard about. I saw a lot of stands like at Tech Ed Europe. I saw you guys were at Ignite. There's just tons of stuff. What is Chef and how does it help streamline this DevOps process?
Absolutely. So at its core, the core product of Chef, which is Chef, is a Chef server and the Chef client. And that's really a mechanism for defining your infrastructure in a codified manner. So we call that infrastructure as code. So what we want to do is instead of thinking about you know, like a bunch of iterative scripts, which we might be used to doing, because a script is just automating a thing that someone's mashing away at a keyboard. Taking something a sysadmin would sit there and would say, okay, well, I'm going to install this package. Now I'm going to hit enter. Now I'm going to copy a bunch, run a robocopy file that's going to run a bunch of stuff and do whatever. Mm-hmm. Really, what we do with Chef is we think more about the desired state. So if you're familiar with desired state configuration and PowerShell DSC, it's a very similar metaphor. And in fact, we integrate directly with DSC. We love DSC.
I'm not familiar with it, but it's just pretty much, this is how I want my world to end up.
Exactly. I don't care how the sausage gets made, right? So a big, so it's about abstraction. You know, there's no problem in, you know, computer science that can't be solved without a sufficient layer of abstraction.
Correct.
So we're all about that. So what I'm doing here is I'm saying my state is that I want these Windows features installed. I don't care how you do that, because the command for doing that might be different on server 2003 than 2008, then it'll be different in Nano and all that kind of stuff. So I'm describing my state. The other piece of that that's really powerful is that it's data driven, right? So I don't have a different script, you know, that's for dev, than is for QA, than is for prod. So what you do in Chef is you write what are called recipes, which are inside cookbooks. Pro tip, never try to write chef code when you're hungry.
Chef, man. That's why it's called Chef.
We are overflowing. Actually, it's called Chef because it's the shortest thing that Adam Jacob could think to type. And he knows sysadmins are lazy. I learned that recently.
That's awesome.
But so what we're doing is we're describing, I like to say that the recipes describe the shape of the dial that you want. And then you set what are called attributes, or basically parameters that might differ from environment to environment or type to type. And so I say your attributes, so the data of that, describe what to set the dial to. Mm-hmm. So the recipe describes a shape, and the attribute you say should it be set to 1, 6, or 11. You know?
I see.
And that gives you the ability to create really data-driven configuration.
Okay. So you're what you're doing is you're writing like a desired end state.
Correct.
And you're, each of these properties, you say, I want the dial of this or to that.
Yes.
So it feels a little inconcrete. Can you show us some stuff?
Absolutely. So I can show you some examples here.
I'm watching your screen right over here.
Okay. So what I'll show you here, so this is a recipe that is for configuring a particular website, and I will tell you, unfortunately, it is, so this is a Linux server, but
that's okay.
We love Linux, right?
We put it on Azure all
and
the time.
And Chef is 100% feature parity with Windows and Linux, so it's just that this was the code I already had. So what I'm doing, if you take a look, for example, this first thing where it says template, this is what we call a resource. And a resource is a component of configuration within Chef, a thing that I care about configuring. Mm-hmm. In this case, I say I want to configure the httpd.conf file. Okay. So I'm saying the path where it should go to. I have the source is what template file do I want to use. And I say who the owner, the group, and the mode should be. Now, what Chef does is we, in configuration management, we use terms like idempotent and convergent, mm-hmm. which are fancy ways of saying test and repair.
Okay.
So what Chef is going to do when it runs down this recipe is it's going to hit that resource and say, is this resource in the state that I want it to be in? If yes, do nothing. If no, then fix it and move on to the next resource. So this can run, so idempotency in mathematics means that every time you run this the operation, you get the same result. So it's like multiplying times one.
Sure.
The idea here is that what Chef is doing, I like to say test and repair. It's testing this. If it needs to be, it's repaired. And then at the end of the run, it will actually report back up to the central server what did it have to change.
Got it.
So I'm setting this template. I'm untarring this particular tarball. I'm setting another template. And I'm extracting some files. This is also depending upon a couple other recipes that I'm using, which ensure that Apache is installed in the way that I expect it to be done. And one of the things that my talk is about, that I'm talking about tomorrow, is talking about the idea of really being able to divide up the work. Mm-hmm. Because systems are really complex. And a lot of times we're used to saying, OK, well, we're going to have an automation group. And they're going to write all the automation and configuration for all of our systems.
Got it.
Problem is, expecting someone to know all of that stuff is a lot of, it's more work to take your automation group who knows how to write automation and teach them all of your intricacies of your business than it is
to have the SQL guy do the SQL stuff.
The SQL part, exactly. The middleware guy do the middleware stuff. And then what happens with that, the concern that always comes up is the, oh my God, anybody can do anything. And I always say, well, can you ship production code whenever you want? No, so it's infrastructure as code. What do? Well, first of all, we version it, we store it in version control, and we use a delivery pipeline like we'll do for our code, which means if I want to make a change to this recipe, which configures my website, I don't just go and pump it up to the Chef server in YOLO mode, right? Yeah. I go and I check it into version control, and it gets picked up by something like Chef Delivery, which is our continuous delivery platform, or TFS, or Jenkins, doesn't matter.
Something.
Whatever's the thing you're... If you're already using something for your apps, you should use the same thing for your infra code.
Right.
And then you apply all the types of testing. You can do smoke testing, linting, functional testing, but then also apply what we call, we have a mode that with our Chef Analytics product, which is what are called audit cookbooks, and they're just defining state that you want to check on. Not things you want to necessarily fix, but say, hey, according to our formal or our informal policy, things like, you know, WinRM should not be enabled or should be enabled in this way or this, that, and the other. And these audit rules run at the same time as your chef runs, but it just simply reports on your compliance.
Okay.
So that's giving you the ability very, I mean, I've been part of audit for my whole career, and I, you know, it's sort of as our product manager for analytics, a guy named Julian Dunn, says he calls it compliance theater, which is the, you know, it's kind of the sine wave of compliance. Oh, the auditors are coming. Now we're going to get really, really compliant because we checked everything. Now it's good. And then we drift and we come down, and we believe in this idea of compliance and velocity, which is you make compliance part of your whole story instead of it being tacked on at the end.
Because a chef recipe would be able to go on there and do all these checks for compliance continuously, right?
Correct. And so the thing is, where the audits come in, the audit mode comes in, is you may not necessarily want Chef to fix the things that it finds that are out of compliance, because maybe it's something that's not under management by Chef, but you already have the Chef client running doing the things under Chef management.
I see.
So it can go ahead and be running these checks at the same time. And then you can sit and say, ah, well, we aren't compliant on this particular feature, so now we know to go back and write some infra code to fix that, because you don't want to necessarily just unleash it on 10,000 nodes and find out, oh, wow, it's going to fix all of these, and maybe there's a reason they're not working right yet. So what I like to do, and this is what I'm going to talk about in my talk tomorrow, is take those same audits that are part of my production audit, and I apply them to my infra code before it even touches any live machine, because I don't want to find out 6 months after I deploy InfraCode and during a pen test that someone went and, you know, enabled passwordless SSH or something like that that's against my compliance. So the idea is compliance and security are really just another aspect of quality.
So when you say InfraCode, you mean infrastructure code
exactly.
that Chef is running to set up infrastructure.
Exactly.
Okay.
The code that I've written that defines what I want.
You can see how developer I am.
Yeah.
You're helping me out.
But that's the thing, and there's, we always like to say, you know, DevOps is a two-way street. A lot of times, traditionally, when people think of DevOps, they think about all this stuff like, oh, those devs need to care about uptime and carry a pager and all this stuff, but Ops has a lot to learn from dev, because in all the things about pair programming and, you know, good practices and test-driven development and all these things, these are solved problems in the development side that we can apply and we have to learn as infra coders and as sysadmins.
So we talked a little bit about the recipes and we saw a
Sure.
So where do these things get run?
So the way that it works is, so you have a central Chef server.
Okay.
And every single node, we call it a node, is any device that you have under management. It can be a VM, can be a cloud instance, can be a physical box, a network switch, storage device, whatever, right? So what, there's something called the Chef client runs on that. It's a very small agent. It's about 32 meg of RAM. It runs inside a vendored Ruby, so it doesn't touch any of your other stuff. And that runs according to whatever interval that you specify. Usually, by default, it will run every 30 minutes or so, but whatever parameters you set. So what happens is, when the Chef client fires off on that node, fires up on a server, first thing it does is run a profiler that we call OHI that collects all sorts of information about the system. Its IP address, its CPU, you know, domain, installed software, you know, what languages are available on it, et cetera, et cetera. And then it reaches out to the Chef server and says, hey, Chef server, I'm this node. And the Chef server says, well, this is what I know about you. You are a web server for application XYZ and environment dev. So I can compile up what I know are the things that are important, and I'm going to ship down those cookbooks to you. And then the Chef client goes and runs through each of those things and then reports back up to the Chef server. And the communication is all over just straight up HTTPS, SSL port 443. You don't open ports on your nodes because it's a pull system.
Sure.
And then at the end, it reports that stuff back up. And then if you're using Chef Analytics, which is an operational database presentation, you have all that operational information of what changed. Did my machines run their audits? Did they pass their audits? All of that piece and part.
So let's see if I understand this right.
Sure.
Every machine that you have in your infrastructure is going to be running, or even in the cloud for that
Absolutely,
matter,
yeah.
Is going to be running Chef Client.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just say you push up a new Chef recipe. You're pushing that to the server?
It eventually makes its way to the server. Ideally, you're doing this through, ideally it's TFS or something that's actually pushing it.
Got it, yeah.
Right, absolutely. But yes, the new version of the cookbook is pushed up to the Chef server.
I like the distinction here. You check in your recipe into version control.
Absolutely.
And then there's some CI process
exactly.
that will push that up. And what's going to happen is, how do you tell like the client machine, because there's a server here and the client over here, how do you tell that this machine now needs to be this recipe?
So if it, how it knows the version. So what we have is there's, when you have a new version of it, now by default, if you don't specify it, it will pull down the latest and greatest, which is not how you want to run production.
Oh, I see.
So in what we call environments, one of the most powerful things about environments is you can constrain the version of the cookbook, and you can and you should, especially mm-hmm. in production. So you can say, so let's say I've written my, you know, site cookbook, you know, site, you know, website or whatever, dot, you know, cookbook. And then I sit there and I say, okay, in production, the version of this equals 1.0, which means even if there's newer versions of that cookbook on the chef server, the nodes in production will only pull down 1.0 until I go and explicitly
change it.
Update that. And you can do that. That's all driven by everything you can do in the chef server is an open RESTful API. We have no private APIs. So if you want to integrate it into your change control system where you can say, okay, when I approve this, then, you know, my CM tool, my change management tool knows how to reach out to the chef server and flip that bit.
Got it.
That can all be file driven. You can store it in version control and promote them that way. You know, big believer, and again, it's not YOLO, right? We're saying governance is an important thing, and that's a big part of why, you know, a lot of our new story around compliance and velocity with Chef Analytics and then Chef Delivery, which is our continuous delivery platform, is we know that having eyes on stuff is really important
cool. In
the DevOps world.
So I'm going to keep going on my little dev mind here.
Yeah.
I stand up three instances of a server in Azure,
mm-hmm.
right? One's for dev, one's for test, and one's for prod.
Yep.
What's going to happen is I'm going to name these things a certain way and say, you always get the latest recipe. You always get the one before the latest one, and you are going to stay at what you're going to stay until I change the state, because we don't want prod to change
sure. Automatically.
Is that how you do it?
Well, you don't necessarily do it by name, no, because you actually do it by environment, right? Yeah. So Chef has a notion of environments, and when you register a machine to the Chef server, you specify,
that's
among other
smarter.
Things, which environment it Absolutely. Should be in.
So I might have like 4, 5, 7, 8, 10 dev boxes that are yep. Running the stuff. A couple of staging and then one prod. And so what you do is when you push up a new prod recipe, it's going to pull it down.
Absolutely.
Okay, or a better one, because we're not going to pull it down automatically because it's prod.
Yeah.
But if you have a new test one, you're going to push a script up and it's going to pull it down.
It's going to pull it down. And you can either, in the case of, you know, you can either wait for the next time that the Chef client would automatically run, or you can, you know, have something that's some task at the end of your TFS build that says, okay, when I push up a new thing,
send
a signal to the client to run, so it runs on demand. Again, a lot, we think about the idea of eventual consistency too as a big thing. And one of the most powerful things of having these environments and having all this data that I talked about that's mm-hmm. collected is this idea of searching for your within your code. So if you think about the idea of instead of, so we'll talk about bad, better, and best way of managing some of this stuff.
That's
so let's
true.
Say I'm writing a recipe that configures my application server. Mm-hmm. And it has one of its parameters is this database connection string. Mm-hmm. What's the name of its database server? So worst is I could hard code that in, write that into the thing, and then I have to have a different recipe for, or if I ever change them, I have to like change my code. We'd want to change the code as little as we need to, because it's the actual steps we're doing.
Right.
So a better way is I might say, oh, well, I'll create an attribute within each environment that says, okay, if it's in dev, then the parameter should be this name of this server. So that's pretty good. But what's even better is letting the system auto-discover. So with search, what happens is every little bit of information that the Chef client knows about itself, the Chef server has in a search index. So what I can do is I can write in my recipe the part when it says, here's how I construct my connection string. Instead of saying, shove in this one value, I can say, do a search for the node with the role database server in the same environment as me. So that way, if I want to spin up another database server, then it will just pick it up on the next run. Or another example we like to use is if you're talking about like a load balancer. So if I'm putting HAProxy or ARR or something like that, instead of when I want to populate that pool, all it's doing, instead of me saying, okay, here's the 10 servers in production that are web servers, oh, now I want to add an 11th one, add that as another attribute, I'm just having my HAProxy or ARR server, when it populates itself every half an hour, it just does a query and says, which are all the servers with the role app server in my same environment? And they won't show up in a search unless they've been properly configured either. So when I first learned this, my ops spidey sense went off and said, so you're going to start shoving machines into the pool that aren't configured? And it's like,
this is
no,
craziness.
If a machine has failed its converge, then it doesn't show up as a search result.
So Chef server is like this master machine that knows about everything that's going on.
Yep.
And then anytime you put something else and it's doing the right thing, it's going to know about it. And then anytime you push a new script up, everyone that's registered with Chef Server, obviously if it has like this continuous thing set up, is going to get the new stuff.
Get the new one, whatever's set to its
That's
availability.
That's awesome. Yeah. So here's the next question that I always wonder about Chef. So we talked about the infrastructure being stood up and then being registered.
Correct.
Is it work backwards? Can the Chef server stand up instances of things and then register and fix them up or run the recipe?
Yeah, actually, so we have a tool we call Chef Provisioning, which initially was called Chef Metal, but that was very confusing because it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with bare metal. It was Chef Metal, like metal, because it's awesome.
Yeah.
But what Chef Provisioning does is it actually, so if you think about our traditional chef recipe, I always like to say it's the things that are inside the node, right? Mm-hmm. It's configuring one machine. So with Chef Provisioning, it gives us two powerful things. One, it gives us a new resource type called machine. So I can say I need machine of type web server 1 to 100, you know, loop through, and machine of type database. So it gives you this lightweight orchestration of I want to have my database server up. It's basically a way of defining a cluster or a group of machines. Uh-huh. But where it gets really powerful is this idea of drivers. So what there are different drivers. There's ones for Azure, for AWS, for VMware, for Hyper-V, for VirtualBox, for pretty much any type of compute layer you might want to have. And then what I do, so I write one recipe, which might be for just the configuration, and then I apply that recipe with the appropriate driver. So I don't write different code for my Azure instances than I do for my Hyper-V instances. Right. I sit and I say, this is a recipe for a group of machines. Now I want to make this group of machines happen in Azure, so I'll call that recipe with the Azure driver that has the appropriate parameters, like my publish settings and
and
the storage account
and
all stuff, versus on Hyper-V it would be the different things. So it's giving you that compute level abstraction, so you can be really cloud agnostic as far as that goes. So it lets you be able to say, if I do it one way inside my data center and I want to put it in Azure, I don't have to change anything.
That's awesome. So, I mean, I heard about, because I remember when Scott Guthrie announced that Chef works in Azure.
Absolutely.
I didn't understand like why it was so important. So if you've been using Chef locally and everything's really working really well, and you decided, well, I want to move all my infrastructure to the cloud, you literally already have all the pieces.
The pieces. It's a common story. There's a really interesting use case. Because the idea when you're treating your infrastructure as code, you should be able to reconstruct your entire business as long as you have access to a data backup, your infra code repo, and your compute resources. So years ago, this company called Custom Ink, who makes awesome t-shirts, among others, the ones that we use at Chef. Mm-hmm. And so they had a scenario, they were in a colo facility somewhere, and they were hit by a DDoS, distributed denial of service attack. Well, they had all their infrastructure all chefed up. So they were able to very easily stand up their entire business again in Amazon without skipping a beat. And it was already there, and they were able to just say, okay, fine, all they had to do was start shunting the traffic over there while they were dealing with how their network pieces got compromised. And then on the opposite end, I don't know if you ever heard of a company called CodeSpaces. It was a SaaS provider for various source code repos. Well, they had a similar thing happen to them when they were in AWS. They got their credentials compromised. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but within a matter of hours, they went out of business because they determined that it was going to cost them more money to reconstruct everything than they were worth.
Oh my goodness.
And again, it's not to say if they're using Chef, they wouldn't have that problem, except if they were using Chef, they wouldn't have that problem.
The thing about it is that I think is interesting here is that even those organizations that are like, we want to move to the cloud.
Yeah.
It might be better to move to like some kind of recipe like Chef system, and then once they can reproduce their system locally, and once they're confident that, hey, we destroyed everything and put everything back up with Chef, you can just move it over to the cloud right away.
The other thing that to me takes us even to another level, and again, as from the developer standpoint about why this is awesome, is how cool would it be if you could easily just spin up a local Hyper-V instance that looks exactly like production? And you develop against that instead of a local IIS on your machine. You know, again, as a career sysadmin, like my biggest like PTSD trigger is it worked on my machine, right? To remove that completely and say, the machine I developed on, I developed on an instance that looks exactly like production except for scale and obviously data.
Sure.
So that way I know. So this is all part of, like, if you think about what's important for continuous delivery, it's that every stage needs to look exactly the same. So production releases are boring. You have to have some kind of infrastructure automation to happen.
So where can people go to learn more?
So the best way to learn more is to go to our learning site, which is learn.chef.io. Mm-hmm. We've got a very easy online tutorial. You don't have to download anything. We give you a little VM in the cloud, so it takes about maybe 10 or 15 minutes to go through the basic tutorial. We've got it for Ubuntu, Red Hat, and Windows, so you can try them all out. There's a set of awesome webinars up there that go through the very similar things we teach in our Chef Fundamentals.
Cool.
There's all sorts of great resources at learn.chef.io. If you're into podcasts, there's a great podcast called The Food Fight Show that's hosted by Nathan Harvey from Chef Software, and they talk about mostly chef things, but also just general DevOps things. Cool. And it's how I learned it. When I was learning chef, you know, I listened to Food Fight and, you know, absorbed about 10% at a time of what I understood and eventually got it. So.
Well, this is really, really useful. Thanks so much for spending some time.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
All right. Well, we are here at that conference on the stage here having a little fireside chat. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time. Take care.